Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to Huff Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
And I'm Haley Birdwell.
And Grace could not be with us for this episode, so we do have to push back our discussion of the second half of Obi-Wan Kenobi for just a little bit longer. But today we're here to discuss who is the coolest Jedi in all of Star Wars. This is a topic that we've wanted to take on for quite a while now because we each have slightly different thoughts, and it's also something that we can keep coming back to with other characters. This time around, Haley has her pick, I have mine, and we will each try to convince you, the listener, that we're right, and hopefully you can let us know how we do. Let's start with you, Haley. I know that you are a huge fan of Ezra Bridger from Star Wars Rebels. Can you just start by giving the elevator pitch for why he's the best?
Yes, and I do want to start with some caveats, because when you go into these kinds of discussions on the internet, I was Googling it today to see what the people think about this, and you'll get a lot of responses like, Ezra doesn't even know all seven lightsaber fighting moves. He's not the he couldn't last 1 minute with Darth. I'm not really judging based on the combat skills, or even, and I feel sort of like a fake fan in this sense, but I haven't read all of the expanded universe, and so there's my base of understanding of Jedi culture is limited to the television shows and to the movies. And other caveat, Ezra's character arc is like subject to change in the future. So this is entirely based on Rebels, the show, and I don't know what they're going to do with him in the live action stuff. But just watching Rebels, and part of this also comes from me being a total dork and also having a kid. So, like, when I think about Rebels, it's like, that's the show that I'm going to show Lewis when he is a little older.
Aww.
I just think that the show itself and the writing in Rebels is so morally rich in ways that other parts of, like, Star Wars aren't. And maybe it's because the main character, Ezra, is younger than other, like, main characters in Star Wars. But I think a lot of, like, the challenges he faces are very relatable. But it's also super refreshing, the choices he makes. So when we meet him, and I guess if you have to summarize Ezra's character, and there's actually, you know, writing advice for characters, which is basically your character needs to have, like, a defining conflict within themselves. Like, one word versus one word. You have to be able to summarize it that way. And if you had to choose one for Ezra, it's, he has to choose between being selfish or being selfless. And, you know, when we meet him, he's, like, selfish. He's trying to survive. And it's understandable, right? Like I mentioned, it's relatable. But he's sort of selfish. And I think, you know, in the early seasons, he sort of has to learn, like, why should I care about other people? Why should I elevate those people's concerns over, you know, my immediate safety? And I think for kids, you know, that's, kids sort of start off selfish too. Like that's a good, like, moral thing, development to watch. But when we see him in the end, like, his last decision is utterly selfless. Like, it is self-sacrificing in a way that is very much what a Jedi should be. So if I had to summarize it, it is, I just think that interplay between those motivations is not just, like, it's both very concrete, relatable to almost everyone, and I think the way they wrote it was just very well done.
Yeah, I think you're right, first of all. I will say that I also am a huge fan of how they approach Ezra's journey and how they build him out, you know, morally as a character. And I guess, you know, let's talk about one of his big tests throughout Star Wars Rebels, which is obviously he is, you know, sort of Kanan takes on the role of being his Jedi teacher, but eventually he comes into contact with Maul, and Maul also tries to influence him and sort of take him under his wing. How do you think Ezra grows and learns from both of these people, and how does that kind of side journey with Maul, how does that influence where he ultimately ends up at the end of the show?
So I will just, in self-defense, I haven't watched it in a little while, so I might be remembering it in a very rosy way. But when I think back on that, and I was trying to look back online and make sure I was remembering it correctly, but it seemed like, I don't know. Ezra just sort of had a sort of intellectual curiosity that isn't entirely bad in the context of what had just happened in the prequels. And it, when it did come down to it, like, he chose to like to make the correct decisions. And when you think about Maul, he sort of, so when I mentioned intellectual curiosity, he really wants to like grow as a Jedi, and he's frustrated throughout the series by the fact that either there's not enough time to do training with Kanan, or even just resources, like the Jedi Order doesn't exist anymore. And so, you know, part of that conflict is this: why should I not use the Sith holocron? Like, I'm not an evil person, why shouldn't I use this information? And obviously, you know, it corrupts, and he has to learn that. But when I think about Maul, when they first sort of meet, it's almost like this empathy from Ezra that sort of draws them closer, and they both have this shared goal of like defeating the Sith, but they sort of, there's like a bonding it, rather than like this sort of abstract I want revenge, or this like just the typical things you see people go to the dark side over. But like when he does have to make the decision, he teeters on the edge and he makes bad decisions, but when it comes down to it, he learns and he makes the right decision. And you know, that is something I wanted to mention too. Like, he's almost the anti Anakin in a sense, and the anti Luke. And I can get into this more later, but when I mention Anakin, like, Ezra from the beginning doesn't have his parents with him, and a huge defining part of Anakin's journey was his mother's death. And Ezra sort of has opportunities along the way to either grow bitter. And he sort of starts out bitter, but to let that define him. And later he even has Palpatine sort of offer this off ramp, you know, and he has to decide against that. So I think I would have to go back and like watch that arc again to see if he did anything that I'm not remembering. But I don't remember having watched that been like, oh, that was, you know, just terrible how he handled all of that.
Yeah, I mean, Kanan obviously tries to play that role of, I mean, you know, because Kanan, obviously, he grew up in the Jedi Order. He has those traditional Jedi teachings. He goes about this a certain way that is based on the Republic era Jedi Order as an institution. You know, how do you teach somebody how to sort of wisely and judiciously use the Force? Now, obviously, he himself was a Padawan when Order 66 happened, so he never actually had formal experience as a teacher, but he's applying what he saw his own master teach him, and he's trying to convey that, whereas Maul, obviously, in large part, is just trying to tempt Ezra for his own purposes, but in interacting with Maul, Ezra does still learn some things, even if it's not deliberate on Maul's part, and those are different lessons. You know, Kanan really, I think, tries to shield Ezra from a lot of, you know, the dark side and the implications of it and the effects of it. And ultimately, you know, in part because Kanan is not able to fully control what Ezra experiences, Ezra ends up learning, you know, through experience, what to watch out for and what to avoid. And for it's sort of a trial by fire. You know, he has to go through it in order to sort of understand why it's a problem. But that ends up being valuable, and perhaps Kanan would never have been able to find a way to teach him all those, you know, those same lessons.
Definitely. I think that's a huge part of it, is almost like tribulation and walking through those kinds of tests and coming out on the other side, making the correct faithful decision. And that's part of why I sometimes like to inexplicably, in conversations with friends, like, for instance, Doctor Strange, I will tell them that it is the most Christian Marvel movie. And it's almost for the same reason that I would say Star Wars Rebels is like, has a lot of those core tenets. And in like I mentioned earlier, it's the selflessness of it, of Ezra's arc. He has to learn, you know, that he's not his own, and he has to make those kinds of decisions to help others. And, you know, it can't just all be, like you mentioned, like book smarts. It can't all just be in principle. Like, you have to live that out in practice. And when he like interacts with Maul, like I mentioned, it's almost empathetic, and like, he gives him a chance. And one part people talk about it a lot, sort of in between, you know, you don't have to be totally light or totally dark. And the character in Rebels, what's his name? The guy who, the like giant creature who sort of interacts with
Ezra. Oh, the Bendu, yeah.
Yeah, he's the best. I liked sort of seeing that interplay in Rebels, because, you know, he ends up on the right side. He ends up on the light side, but you have to sort of interact with those things and learn from them and end up making the correct decision for it to be meaningful, instead of just in principle. But I do want to get into, before we move on to your favorite Jedi, there's another like sort of dweeby childlike reason that I love Ezra, and it is just his connection to animals, which we don't really see elsewhere with Jedi. It plays out in like with several different kinds of animals, but I just think it's really special and fun. And then the other thing, I mentioned he's sort of the anti-Anakin and the anti-Luke. And maybe that's a little sweeping statement, a little too sweeping, but the reason I say that, and I've mentioned this in an earlier podcast, is because Ezra's, and it's almost like precluded in the prequel era because force sensitive, like younglings are just taken from their families and from their homes. So they don't really establish those connections. So not to fault them for it, but Ezra is just, he has such a deep connection to his home planet, that I find just really like powerful, like touching in terms of the story. And in the same sense that he has a very deep connection to his family, his parents who are no longer alive. Luke is always in the later movies is always sort of trying to get away from Tatooine, trying to get away from his home. He's tired of it. He's bored of it. Ezra throughout Rebels is always trying to go back. He's always trying to go back. And when you get to the end, he's back, but he has to leave. That is like another element of the self-sacrifice. In order to save the planet he cares about so much, he has to leave it and go who knows where. And I just think, you know, in ways that you're not really able to tell that story with other Jedi, with Ezra, you get to see that story of a Force-sensitive person trying to sort of live the Jedi way, but still really like deeply connected to their home world.
Yeah, he's also, I think, really the only main character that we see having a strong connection to their home planet in the foreground of the story, where it's actually mm-hmm. part of what's driving them and what is creating conflict and what is helping to resolve the conflict. I mean, the only other character we see who actually enjoys being on their home planet, I think, is Padme, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Luke and Anakin, obviously, we see a lot of them on their home planet, but they don't like Tatooine. You know, we don't really see other home planets, at least not in the films. Obviously, there are characters in the Clone Wars who, I mean, there's, you know, a story arc set on, you know, Mon Cala, and we see, you know, Ackbar and stuff there, but certainly not to the degree that the Ezra Lothal kind of connection, you know, that gets a really significant treatment in Rebels. It's in the foreground of the story, and it does, as you said, help establish that this is a person who has a deep sense of community that would not have existed if he were a traditional Jedi. He would have been taken from his home. He would not have any of that emotional grounding to that place and to those people. Well, all right, we've talked about a character that we met fairly recently in the history of Star Wars, a relatively young character, a character who is on the irreverent side, if you will. Let's switch gears and talk about somebody we've known for more than 20 years at this point, a character who is not quite a young'un and also not quite the funniest character in the drawer of Star Wars characters. I would say my favorite Jedi, my pick for the coolest Jedi, is Mace Windu. And I know that as I say that, there are people out there who are going to say, oh, Eric, I can't believe you like Mace Windu. He's horrible. He's everything that's wrong with the Jedi Order. He's the reason for everything falling apart. No. Let me make the case to you that that is wrong, and that, in fact, Mace Windu is not as much a problem for the Jedi Order as he is a doomed person attempting to right the ship, certainly up against more than he bargained for, but more on the right side of things than the wrong side of things. I won't go through everything there is to like about Mace Windu, but I will say this. You can tell consistently throughout the prequels, and the Clone Wars does a great job of this too, he doesn't trust Palpatine, so he's not one of the Jedi who has the wool pulled over his eyes. He is not trusting by nature, and in this case, that works to his benefit. He says explicitly he doesn't think Palpatine will give up power when the war ends, so he's very vigilant about looking for any sign that Palpatine is going to betray the Republic. On a more kind of just fanboy level, I mean, he's he has this extreme discipline and steadfastness and level-headedness that I think is kind of the quintessential Jedi trait, right? I mean, there are Jedi who embody a more kind of chaotic energy. Anakin would be a classic example of that. Mace Windu is sort of similar to Qui-Gon, which I think a lot of people like this about him, is that he's more measured and reserved. At the same time, though, he is very capable with the Force, and he is a total pro with his lightsaber, which obviously is very cool to see, whether it is in the Geonosian arena or, you know, the Genndy Tartakovsky Clone Wars series, which we really do want to talk about here on Hoth Takes at some point, because that's another great example of Star Wars storytelling, even if it's more of like the tall tales format. I mean, that episode where he just wipes out an entire droid army, you know, you wouldn't really do that with any other Jedi. There's a reason they picked Mace Windu for that little vignette, and it's because he's the one who embodies this supreme competence and confidence and proficiency. And I just enjoy seeing that from a Jedi, because we see a lot of Jedi who fall down on the job for various story reasons. You know, Grievous kills them or they make some other mistake that leads to their death, and it advances the story in all those cases. But it's fun to see somebody who actually is just a total boss and a total pro. Not to say that he is perfect, but he's certainly depicted as somebody who really has his act together, and I enjoy watching that. I'll make one more point, and then Haley, I'd love to hear you jump in with your thoughts, and maybe we can discuss him a little bit. I think he is unique in that he's able to walk the line between the light side, the traditional Jedi practices, and the dark side, which gets stuff done, but obviously corrupts you in the process of giving you that easy resolution. He's able to walk that line. You know, when he beheads Jango Fett in the arena, that's a pretty brutal act. But it doesn't corrupt him, and you don't really, certainly the prequel trilogy and also the Clone Wars series doesn't give you the sense that in doing that he has tapped into something fundamentally wicked and he will never be the same. You know, they just present that as he does what needs to be done. And I think that that's just really cool. You know, one other thing that they bring in from the expanded universe, this is, they made this canon at some point. You know, he has this discipline of one of the extremely complicated and extremely dangerous forms of lightsaber combat called Vapod, which I looked it up on Wikipedia, says he's one of only two people who's able to use this very kind of walking the line, you know, full of power and not really menace, but just force. He's able to use this form of lightsaber combat without falling to the dark side, which gives you a sense of the extreme discipline and composure of a person who is able to walk up to, you know, something that somebody might perhaps see as like the dark arts, but not be drawn in by it, right? He's able to step back and he's able to use it as a tool when that degree of ferocity is necessary, but he is mature enough and careful enough and well-trained enough that he does not fall to the dark side by tapping into that power. So I just think that's really cool.
I think you summarized it really well, Eric. And in the words that stand out to me that I agree wholeheartedly with are just maturity and discipline. That really comes across. He's not my favorite Jedi in the sense that he is yours, because I watched the prequels as a kid, and he's sort of like, this party's over. And he's not a lot of fun.
No, he's not. He's not Mr. Happy Pants.
He's not, but you're right that he's sort of like fighting against institutions that are decaying. And so he's almost this tragic figure of trying to hold fast to what the Jedi Order is supposed to be about in a time where he wasn't really able to continue doing that. And I know there's all kinds of fan theories, like maybe he survived being thrown out the window and like stabbed or whatever. Did his hand get cut off?
Yes, that Anakin cut off his hand. Yeah.
Well, we know he can survive that, given Star Wars precedent.
You can survive being cut in half. You can survive being electrocuted and thrown down a reactor shaft. I mean, there's certainly nothing in canon that would completely rule out Mace Windu being alive.
I think it would be cool to see him back, sort of in the debate post-sequels of what the Jedi are supposed to be about, which I'm not really sure how old he would be at that point, but, you know, other people are alive at that point, so he should be alive if he survived. So I don't know. I think he, sort of for the reasons that you like him, is just a very stalwart, pragmatic realist. but I don't have much affection for Mace Windu. And I don't know if that's just because he's so serious all the time.
Well, one thing you said you made a great point, which is that he's fighting against a rising tide of corruption and decay. And as I said before, he's doomed to fail. We know this. But he really does, embody this, the Jedi of the late Republic era being really challenged by the conflicts and the forces that get put in play by Sidious. When the Clone War breaks out, he has to make a choice of, does he embrace this new role as a general in the army, or does he try to stick to the theoretical principles of the order as much as possible? And there's a point in his journey where he actually, suggests, what if we actually assassinate Count Dooku and try to bring the war to a close to prevent, the more bloodshed, essentially, to try to save more innocent lives. And Obi-Wan says, we can't do that. That's not the Jedi way. And Mace Windu points out, and when I was scrolling through Wikipedia, I remembered reading this passage and not remembering where I'd seen it before, but it is in canon that this happened. And Mace Windu basically says, look, if you want to talk about what's against the Jedi way, how about allowing innocent suffering on an unprecedented scale, right? I mean, we have an obligation to embrace our new role as people who are trying to stop things from getting worse. We can't do anything about the fact that the war has broken out. That has happened. How can we minimize suffering? And the way to do it is to try to bring the war to a close quickly. It's to try to fight with all of your energy on every battlefront, because every planet you save, that's a planet full of people who are not going to have to live under separatist occupation. Yes, the growth of the war machine perpetuates the conflict and makes it more attractive to prolong the conflict, but that's not in his control. All he can do is say, how should the Jedi proceed? What role should we play? How far should we push back on being asked to lead this army? And he basically comes to the conclusion that, look, we've been dealt a bad hand, but there's a clear moral imperative here to save innocent lives. And I just think that that is such an interesting dynamic. And I love that in canon, he's one of those people who's really wrestling with that dilemma.
Yeah, definitely. Eric, do you have a favorite, like, Mace Windu moment?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, Haley, because it might honestly be "This Party's Over," because he comes in and you can tell immediately that Count Dooku, who is a person who we have seen be pretty fearless up to this point, Count Dooku, very powerful guy, not much scares him, but Mace Windu rattles him, right? And it's not that he goes running, but this is clearly not what he expected, and it's also clearly a person that he hadn't counted on having to deal with, and it unnerves him. And, it's clearly Samuel L. Jackson is going ham on that line and really trying to put as much, of the classic Mace Windu, boss energy into that line. But I think it works really well. And then you combine it with kind of the montage of all the Jedi, turning on their lightsabers. And obviously they, need the clone army to come in and save the day. But in that moment, there's a certain heroic, there's a sense of triumph there. And I like that he kind of touches things off by basically telling Count Dooku directly to his face, like, yeah, it's not going to go this way, buddy. I'm sorry, but we're here to put an end to this little charade. And I like that a lot. There's also good stuff in the Clone Wars, too. I will say, I love the story arc where Boba Fett tries to kill him in out of revenge. And he and Anakin, who we don't really see working together a lot, they end up on this mission. They're trapped in the wreckage of this Star Destroyer, and they have to trust each other. And ultimately, at the end of the day, you see Mace Windu develop grudging respect for Anakin and a recognition that perhaps he's not just this impetuous, fly by the seat of your pants, sort of a different type of Jedi that is not good for the Order. Perhaps actually he does have some allegiance to the broader principles that Mace Windu also shares, and they have some common ground there. And I will also say, at the end of that episode, he develops a grudging respect for R2-D2 as well, after previously being a little bit dismissive of him. And as someone who, R2-D2 is my favorite character, I did enjoy seeing that, Mace Windu was able to give credit where due at the end of that episode, because R2 ultimately saves the day. And I think that I think it's a reflection of the fact that he's not quite as dogmatic as people like to portray him as. And actually, Haley, I would love to get your thoughts on that big question about Mace Windu, which is, does he, with his hostility to Anakin, his skepticism of Anakin, right from the beginning in Phantom Menace, does he ultimately create a self-fulfilling prophecy of Anakin's alienation from the Jedi Order? Or is that, you know, how much do you put that on Mace Windu, basically?
I don't. And I, like, I see why, because he sort of, I don't know, pushes him at times in ways that aren't super constructive. But the skepticism itself would have been nice for other people to have, to the same extent that Mace Windu had it. And it's almost like maybe he should have maintained the skepticism, but not been so open about it to Anakin. I would not say that it is the reason for it, but I would say maybe it didn't help. Like, maybe it was a little bit of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Anakin is, right from the beginning, when he comes in and he has this existing attachment to his mother is still a slave, that obviously presents the potential for a lot of emotional turmoil. You know, as a Jedi Master sitting in that council chamber, that you have to sort of tiptoe around this kid, or, you know, or you're going to set him off, basically, and you could make things a lot worse. And he's the chosen one, so you need him, so you have to sort of appease him to some degree. Mace Windu is one of the very few who basically overtly says, like, I'm not gonna tiptoe around this issue. Like, you are not fit to be a Jedi. You have baggage that we explicitly try to avoid. And, you know, you're not at a point where you've been disciplined enough. Again, coming back to that idea of discipline, of stepping back from the emotional temptation. You know, clearly Anakin wasn't raised to be able to do that. And I think, as much as I understand and agree with the criticism of the Jedi Order, we had an episode about this, right? Is how to rethink attachment and the policies about attachment. I still don't think that a lot could have been done with Anakin at age 8 or whatever, to temper that fire and bring him to a place where he was better able to suppress that emotional obsession and focus on his job. I think he was destined to have that constantly nagging at him, and I think ultimately he was destined to end up where he ends up on Tatooine, slaughtering the village of Tusken Raiders. I don't think that is the result of some kind of embitterment with Mace Windu or with, you know, with the strictures of the Jedi Order. Like, I don't think that a more permissive, a more, like, friendly Jedi Order would have prevented that. Now, maybe if the Jedi had rescued, you know, Shmi Skywalker and brought her to Coruscant, things would have been different, but you can't just go around and, you know, collect the family members of every Jedi in the Order, you know, so that they will be safe and so that they will never be a potential source of anxiety for Jedi. I mean, you have to imagine that there are other Jedi out there who are constantly thinking about, well, what about my family who I never knew? Are they safe? Are they in danger? Now, you know, when you know your family, it's a little bit different, but it's not like Anakin's the only person who has ever had the potential to be distracted by fear that other people were suffering, right? You know, plenty of Jedi were susceptible to that same kind of temptation. It's a little bit more acute with Anakin, so I'm not trying to downplay that, but I don't agree with the people who hold up Mace Windu as this poster child for a fatally inflexible order that should have accommodated Anakin Skywalker more. I just don't see that as being, you know, the fatal flaw here. I think Sidious's plan, while it benefited from the rigidity of the Jedi policies, I don't think if you take that away, you suddenly eliminate Sidious's plan.
You know, yeah, the plan almost benefits also from friends of Anakin's who weren't disciplined enough with him. Like if you had everybody treating him like Mace Windu did, I don't know if he would have gotten away with the Padme situation without more people noticing. Like Obi-Wan sort of understood what was happening near the end, but it was foolish to, like, send him with a childhood friend to a planet all alone to be her personal guard. And, like nobody raised any red flags about that.
It's like, I'm sorry, you're going to send the two most beautiful people in this entire trilogy to a lakeside retreat without any adult supervision? Yeah, okay, that's a great idea.
He needed a chaperone.
Yeah, there needed to be somebody sitting at that dinner table and saying, like, sorry, 6 feet apart.
This party's over. 6 feet apart.
This party's over. Yeah, Mace Windu walking through the door, and he sits down. He pulls up a third chair, and he sits down, and he goes, this party's over. And the Anakin is floating the fruit across the table, and he grabs it. He just grabs it out of the air, and he eats it, and he's like, I think not, Skywalker.
He needed more of that. Yeah. Before we finish up, I do want to talk about, I don't know if we've talked about it in other episodes. We may have, but it's all blurred to me. We've talked about your favorite Mace Windu moment. There's many of, like, favorite Ezra moments for me, but I do want to talk about the World Between Worlds episode, which I just think almost everything I was talking about in terms of character development, and almost when you compare it to other Jedi, he's sort of faced with, like, absolute power in this moment where he is able to, like, change the past, save people who have already died. And, like, he saves Ahsoka, but when he's, like, confronted with this decision of, should I try to save Kanan, Ahsoka is sort of able to talk him down, and it almost comes down to this question of, like, will you honor that sacrifice without tampering? And, like, he chooses not to change it, and I just found that really powerful. I thought, and I know it, like, changes the whole canon of Star Wars to have the ability to, like, go back in time in this way, but I really like it. There's almost this undercurrent in Rebels of just spiritual mysticism. And you get that with the Loth Wolves and sort of the animals, in it sort of communicating with Ezra, or he has a lot of different dreams, things like that. But this World Between Worlds is sort of like the culmination of that. And I just thought it was really interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, we were talking about discipline with Mace Windu. Well, you know, here is Ezra faced with one of the most seductive temptations anyone has ever faced. And he's able to listen to Ahsoka and ultimately do the right thing. You know, I don't know that he would have made that choice a few years earlier when we meet him at the beginning of Rebels. I think you can make a compelling argument that he has one of the best, if not the best, journey of growth and maturity in the entire Star Wars saga. You know, Luke obviously is the classic example, but that happens across a handful of hours in three movies, and a lot of it, frankly, is off screen in between episodes 5 and 6. That's a huge unexplored part of Luke, you know, learning and maturing, and you know, you can tell by the shock that people have when they first see him in Return of the Jedi. What that really tells you is he's a very different person than the last time we saw him in 1980. Ezra, you see pretty much every stage of his growth and his journey. You see every bit of that for the most part, and I think we're better for it. I mean, I think it's, as you said, a great morally rich depiction of a young man who is, you know, growing up in this era where he's presented with all these different tests. And for the most part, he makes the right decision. And certainly by the end of the series, he's making the right decision a lot more than he would have earlier.
Yeah. And that's why I'm sort of nervous about the new shows. Like, I'm going to be one of those old people who was very attached to, like, Luke back in the day. And then he throws the lightsaber and it's like, ah, what did they do to Luke? I don't want them to, like, send Ezra to the dark side, but he's so, like, he's young when we last see him, and, like, there is the room for that, but I don't want them to. I just thought the writing in the arc itself is just so well done in that series.
You know, I actually did want to ask you how you want to see him, you know, portrayed, because as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, he's this kind of, there's a lot of slapstick comedy, there's, you know, there's physical comedy, he's a very irreverent little kid, he's kind of annoying. Not quite, you know, early Ahsoka vibes, but not super far off from it either. And then, of course, by the end of the series, he's practically as stoic and mature as, you know, Luke was in Return of the Jedi. How much do you want to see the flashes of early Ezra in whatever we get from the new series? Do you want him to be more like Luke in Return of the Jedi, where he's not, you know, he's not cracking jokes, he's not, you know, there isn't a lot of comedy there, even if he will smile occasionally, he's a very changed person? Or do you want to see more of that kind of early Ezra mixed in there?
I don't think they should eliminate, I think the way he is, has a sense of humor, is really integral to his character. I don't want him to have been through so much trauma or something on wherever he goes with Thrawn that he's, like, super far from the person he used to be. Like, that would just be sort of sad for me. And I know it's, like, maybe they'll do that. I don't, I think sort of some of the charm of Ezra is even when he is in alignment with like Jedi Order teachings in the light side, he is sort of goofy. And he does have like a more of a flexibility to him without ever going too far. Like Anakin definitely was goofy at times and had a flexibility, but it was dangerous. And I don't, even when Ezra's goofing around with the holocron and like hanging out with Darth Maul, I don't remember ever being like, oh, this kid's gonna like be evil and turn. Like, I never got that sense. And maybe I was supposed to, and I just liked Ezra too much, but it was like, yeah, I could see why he wanted to know what was in the holocron. And maybe that means I like am a dark side adjacent kind of person to have been interested in that kind of thing. But no, I would rather see him more like he was, but without losing sort of the lessons he's learned along the way.
I think, yeah, that's also what I want to see. I think you described it really well that, you know, ultimately, what is this all for if he has to lose that core piece of himself, that sense of humor, that sense of really the light side in him? I mean, I don't want that to go away and for him to suddenly become, you know, totally, you know, stoic and reserved at all times. That we need to see those flashes of, you know, ultimately where he comes from and who he is at his core, because I don't think that has suddenly changed.
Now, in terms of, like, the actual storyline, I just want him to get to go home and, like, have a family. And, like, I don't want him to be caught up in interstellar intrigue anymore. Like, throughout the series, he just wants to be at home. And you know, it the series ends with Lothal being sort of free and having more ability to develop and become sort of thriving. I want him to like get to settle down, which I know a lot of people in Star Wars don't get to, and you know, sequel trilogy happens and there's more bad guys all the time. But my dream plot for Ezra is probably not going to happen, or maybe there's threats at home he has to deal with. But even that would be nice for a change, you know, to have him sort of settled down, which I realize is not compelling television. Like, it's unlikely that that's going to be the Ezra situation, that he has settled down with Sabine in some village on the fall and has three children, you know, a decade from now or something. Like, that's probably not how it's going to end up, but I would like for it to end up that way.
Okay, so an Ezra-Sabine shipper, I see.
Yeah, obviously.
So what is his occupation in his quiet country life on Lothal? Is he breeding like Lothwolves? Is he a farmer? Is he like, does he do like nature tours of the Lothal countryside? What is his profession in your view?
Oh, he's definitely like a Meilu Run vendor. He definitely goes to the farmer's market every day.
He is like sitting there amongst these just like, let's just be honest, people who don't have his backstory. Like, there's just a line of vendors and like these schlubby, you know, fruit and like meat salesmen, and then it's like Ezra Bridger and like somebody will be at the market and they'll be like, you look so familiar. Have I seen you before? And he's like, no, I get that a lot though. Mailer runs are half off today. Like, I just like the idea that it would be like Luke Skywalker, you know, working at like a Best Buy.
I mean, I almost appreciate the spiritual hermit sort of vibe that Luke Skywalker had near the end. And I think that would be good for Ezra in a way, but I don't want him to be like a cranky, lonely old man eventually, you know? I don't like that. Almost sort of what I've been talking about. He values community a lot, and I would like to see him get to have his own, like, In the same way that the ghost and the sort of crew of the ship was like a found family for him to be able to settle down and have a family. But that's just the dork in me. I don't get to write Star Wars. Hey, no, now that I have given you my fan desires about Ezra, you have to tell me what you want to happen for Mace Windu.
You know, you were talking earlier about him showing up in like the sequel era or whatever. I do think that like at that point he would probably be too old to be as like as cool and like a boss, you know, as as the prequel era. If they let me just say this. I'm not one of those Mace Windu fans who's like, they've got to bring him back. There's no justice in his story if they don't bring him back. He had to have survived that fall. It's totally ridiculous that they're saying that he's dead. Like, I don't feel that way. I'm happy for his story to end where it does. That being said, if they choose to bring him back, if they're like, okay, we're bringing him back, I want it to be in that, you know, post Revenge of the Sith, you know, Rise of the Empire era. There were some cool books in that era in the expanded universe chronicling what it's like to be a Jedi on the run as the Empire is rising up around you. If they're gonna bring Mace Windu back, I think it should be in that time period. You know, he can have like a robot hand. It can be a nice little parallel with Anakin, who cut off his hand, you know, as long as he gets that medical attention right away. Theoretically, maybe it would be fine. Maybe the lightning was not as bad as it looked. Like, if he survives somehow, I want to see Mace Windu in the Coruscant underworld struggling to reconcile his instincts with the imperative that he stay hidden, because he's going to want to get out there and take action. He's a man of action. And I would want to see him have to face the fact that that's no longer the world that he lives in. But as I said, I'm not somebody who's out here saying it has to happen. I think that Mace Windu's story has come to a natural conclusion, and I am happy for it to end that way. But if Disney would like me to be a consultant on a Mace Windu limited series, I'm sure Samuel L. Jackson would come back for it. The man does not look a day older than he did back then, so it would be cool to do. And Disney, you know, feel free to call me.
That was actually a very good pitch, and I'm sure that the people listening can pull those strings. One thing you mentioned that I... just in terms of pure setting that I would love to see is Coruscant Underworld. Like that, like everything about the pitch just then sounds good. Like it should. It should be a thing.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Hoth Takes. If you want to share your thoughts about the show or suggest topics for future episodes, you can email us at hothtakes@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller on Twitter. Grace is Grace_Seegers, and Haley is Birdinator. Haley made our incredible logo and banner art, and I edited the show and put together our music. Although, again, for legal purposes, we do want to note that all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, that is hothtakes.wordpress.com. And hey, if you like the show, please share it with a friend. You can find Hoth Takes on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.